From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, Pew Research reports that more Christian than Muslim refugees have been admitted to the United States in the first months of the Trump administration. This reverses the trend seen in the last year under Barack Obama. Arkansas lawmakers seem ready to not interfere in the right of a rape victim who becomes pregnant to obtain an abortion as long as she notifies her rapist first. You heard that right. House Bill 1566 would make it illegal for a woman to have an abortion without communicating with the man who impregnated her first. And even participants called it surreal. Gathered in the Oval Office this week, surrounding the President of the United States, evangelical pastors laid hands on the President and prayed. At a time of great contentiousness, this certainly serves to only further divide an electorate in what is still a secular, pluralistic nation. It didn't help that one participant said that they used to also pray with Obama. But with Trump, it is different. Quote, we're praying within the context of a real relationship, of true friendship, he said. News is moving extraordinarily quickly in our nation right now. This week on State of Belief, we'll step off the headline-chasing treadmill to revisit three past conversations with book authors that retain their importance and relevance today. I'll also have a few new thoughts to share with you before we go. Professor of Cognitive Linguistics George Lakoff has been outspoken in his analysis of our political discourse since the election. Renowned as the father of framing, George is the author of numerous important books, including Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, which was published in an updated paperback edition late last year. We'll revisit that interview on this week's show. In 2012, we aired a conversation with Dr. Nora Rose Musnick, who had just published an inspiring book titled Arab and Jewish Women in Kentucky, Stories of Audacity and Accommodation. In an age when it too often seems all we see are our differences, I think it's high time to hear that interview once again. But first, a conversation from last summer that has turned out to be more predictive than anyone could have imagined, but in a way that I think nobody fully expected. With a vast trove of insights into American values and opinions, thanks to his role as longtime CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, Dr. Robert P. Jones published the book, The End of White Christian America. It garnered a great deal of attention and, in fact, has just been released in paperback. The arguments Robbie makes in this book are as valid today as when he made them in advance of the 2016 election. But the backlash that he also predicted would accompany the end of this kind of America has, I think, been beyond what any of us expected. I think it's fair to say There are many people among us that would actually rather see the literal end of America itself rather than the kinds of changes Robbie's meticulous research describes as inevitable. With that in mind, here's that conversation from July of 2016. There are two enormous questions implicit in the book's title, The End of White Christian America. How big a change is this for our nation, and what does it mean for those who simply refuse to face this change? I'd like for you to address both of those questions, if you would.
Well, you know, it's an enormous change, and what's, I think, striking about it and what really made me write the book is that it's a change that in many ways has been right in front of us, but not one that I think had been identified. So just to give you, you know, a sense of it, I mean, we've all known that, you know, the country's been shifting in terms of its demographics, becoming more diverse, the younger generation is more diverse than older older generations, and the demographers have been telling us, you know, first they told us it was going to be 2050 when the country was going to be a majority minority nation, a non-white nation. Then that number got moved up to 2042 as the changes have been accelerating. But I think what people miss is that we had actually already crossed a very significant threshold, and that is we had moved just during the last decade from being a majority white Christian country to a minority white Christian country. And that shift, I think, helps really explain a lot of the visceral reactions we're seeing in today's politics, a lot of the anxieties that we're seeing, particularly among conservative white Christians in the country. And just to give you, you know, two quick numbers. So at the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency, the country was 54% white and Christian. So still solidly majority. Our latest numbers at the end of 2015 show that number has slipped to 45%. So just during Barack Obama's presidency, we've gone from being a 54% white Christian nation to a 45% white Christian nation.
That is amazing. When did this change occur statistically? Was it within this period of the Obama administration, or what else would you say about that?
Well, you know, we had really the 1990s were the time when we really began to see these trends accelerate. We began to see, you know, it was important to remember that in the 1990s, when you asked people about their religious affiliation, less than 10% of the country in the early 1990s claimed no religious affiliation at all. And the country was still even majority white and Protestant in the early 1990s. But what we began to see over time, like today, for example, you know, 23% of the country claims no religious affiliation whatsoever. So that's part of the story, is this kind of, you know, people actually leaving formal affiliations with religion, and that has happened disproportionately among white religious Americans. And so that's part of the story that we're seeing today. But we really do see it beginning in the 1990s, but then really accelerating over these last 10 years. And, you know, the other thing to say, I think, is that there's been a couple of important symbols. I've mentioned Barack Obama's presidency. He obviously, of course, is the first African-American president who obviously doesn't come from the world of white Christian America. One more just in 2010, in the same period, that the U.S. Supreme Court lost its last Protestant justice. Historically, 91 of the 112 justices that have ever sat on the court have been Protestant, and we lost our last Protestant in 2010. And if Merrick Garland is confirmed, we would have a Supreme Court that consists of five Catholic justices and four Jews.
Goodness gracious. Well, when do you think the public started really seeing the effects of the shift?
Yeah. Well, you know, you and I have talked a lot about the rise of the Christian right in the 1980s and the 1990s, and I think with the benefit of hindsight, you know, we can see that more was going on there than just a reaction to this kind of what we're seeing as the kind of libertine 1960s. You know, that was that sort of shock to the system was real, but it sort of set off, you know, a number of other shockwaves, and that so the Christian right, I think, was kind of one piece of that reaction. But even what's different, I think, today is that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I mean, the kind of phrase the moral majority was used, you know, by the Christian right. And they had a way of kind of making a claim that they had their fingers on the center of American culture and that they were really standing for mainstream America. And I think what's different today is that when we see conservative Christians, you know, in the public sphere, they're not really, even they know they can't make that argument anymore. You know, so the country, again, so one other thing is the same period, the country's gone from being, in 2008, a country that only 4 in 10 supported gay marriage, and now 53% support gay marriage. And so that's another sort of big cultural shift. And I think the what has changed is that for the kind of conservative Christian movement that's sort of overwhelmingly made up of white Christians, they have sort of sensed that the country has sort of moved in a way that not only demographically but culturally they're no longer at the center of where the country is. And that dynamic, I think, has really set the stage well for kind of where we are in the campaign that we're seeing today.
You know, we have a tendency, and right now it's on steroids, to blame almost everything that happens on politics. In this case, this is not a consequence of politics nearly so much as it is a phenomenon that has changed politics. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah, you know, I think if we're thinking about Donald Trump's rise, I think, you know, within the Republican Party, I think it's not really possible to think about that being a reality if he hadn't stepped onto the stage just as the curtain was coming down on the last act of, you know, white Christian America. And I think it's that sense of, you know, what we're seeing in the survey data among white evangelicals and white Christians generally is the sense of deep sense of nostalgia for the past, a real sense of anxiety and vulnerability about the country changing, and their vision that they had, I think, of what America is and what the country is, you know, they feel that, I think, slipping away. And I think that sense of anxiety, anger, and a real sense of nostalgia for the past. So Trump's slogan, for example, of make America great again, you know, the power that last word again has is really dependent on these cultural changes that we've been talking about and the sense of anxiety that many white conservative Christians feel around those changes.
Robbie, do you see segments of our population that are really embracing these changes effectively?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I do in the book is I begin the book with an obituary for white Christian America, and I end the book with a eulogy where I try to kind of address, you know, where different groups are in reacting to the end of this era in American and public life. And, you know, I do think there are some groups that are trying to sort this out. I mean, the mainline Protestant churches, you know, the Episcopalians, the kind of more liberal or progressive wing of white Protestantism, has had a few more decades to deal with this because their decline actually came more in the 70s and 80s and kind of and 90s and has, you know, that now stabilized a bit. So they've had a few more decades to kind of think about what it means, you know, for to kind of move from the center of power to being one among many groups at the table. I think the group that is struggling with this are really white evangelical Christians who really have only seen their numbers declining in the last 10 years. So before that, there was this sense that white evangelicals were looking at their more liberal brethren and blaming liberal theology for their decline. Mm-hmm. And now what we see is actually what the real story is that they just experienced the decline a few decades before white evangelicals have.
My own sense is, Robbie, that white Americans are not going easily into that good night. And so it makes me ask, is what's happening among white Americans and some fear because of what's happening, does this relate at all to issues like the white-on-black crime that we're seeing, or maybe not always crime, but the white-on-black killing that we're seeing even in the community that is called and empowered to protect people rather than not to protect them. Is that a part of this as well?
Yeah, no, I spent a whole chapter, you know, trying to unpack race and racial perceptions and how that's playing a role here. And you know, with Alton Sterling, with Michael Brown, with these other killings of African American men by police, we do see a very dramatic difference. And you know, part of this is about like what is the perception? And we had a survey question where we asked, do you think the recent killings of African-American men by police are part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans, or do you think they're simply isolated incidents? And what's remarkable is that we've asked this question a number of times. The same pattern always emerges. About 8 in 10 African-Americans say this is absolutely part of a pattern of the way police treat African-Americans. But when you look at whites overall, only about 45% of whites agree with that statement. So it's about half as many whites agree with that statement. If you break it down even further, it's white Christians, actually, both mainline Protestants and evangelicals, who are less likely to believe this, that it's part of a pattern, than whites who claim no religious affiliation. About two-thirds of whites who claim no religious affiliation agree with African-Americans that this is part of a broader pattern. But there is something about sort of white Christian affiliation that is sort of much less likely to perceive these patterns. And among evangelicals, for example, it's only about 3 in 10 evangelicals who say that this is part of a pattern. The overwhelming majority say, no, these are just isolated incidents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's hard to sort of get to solutions when you can't even agree about the reality of the problem, or you can't even come to an agreement on the reality of the problem.
Yeah,
and I think that's where we are, and it's pretty stark, and I think a pretty tough, a pretty tough set of opinions that make I think coming to some solutions here pretty difficult.
Who is it that is saying, well, figures be damned? Who is in just stubborn denial regarding what you're proving to us?
Yeah. So that last chapter in the eulogy, one of the things I do is I blatantly rip off Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Grief to kind of take as a framework for kind of understanding. And so denial, right, is one of the anger and denial are these kind of linked stages of grief. And I think that there are some very clear examples. I would say probably the most straightforward example is probably Franklin Graham, which may be a little bit ironic given the state that his father, Billy Graham, was not really someone who you would associate with a kind of culture war, you know, approach to power, and it wasn't overly kind of partisan and political. But Franklin Graham has, you know, explicitly called on the revival of the Christian right, has been so opposed to President Obama at every turn, and most recently in a meeting in Manhattan with evangelical leaders, was one of the key people introducing Donald Trump, believe it or not, with a smattering of biblical heroes that he was using to set the stage for his support for Donald Trump, basically arguing that there's all kinds of flawed biblical heroes in the Bible. There's only one person, Jesus Christ, one perfect person, Jesus Christ, and he's not running for president. And that was sort of part of his justification for supporting Trump. But I think that justification really is rooted in, you know, a kind of fight to the death to bring back this lost world of white Christian America, and they see Trump as a person who's willing to do that. And Trump himself has very explicitly said, you know, when I'm elected president, I'm going to restore power to the Christian churches. Mm-hmm. And so he's made that direct appeal to those groups.
Are you hopeful or not hopeful about what's next for our country?
You know, I think I'm hopeful about the long run. I think in many ways, you know, we have been here in some ways before, in some ways we haven't, but, you know, we have been in a place where we have had to integrate Catholics into mainstream America. We had to integrate Jews into mainstream America, and there was some seriously ugly periods of American history when that was happening, and then we seem to have gotten to a place. You know, I think in the short term, I'm worried that we may see some real flashpoints, and I think Trump is, you know, Exhibit A. Trump's rise in the Republican Party is Exhibit A of that. I think I'm hopeful that those are, in some ways, you know, the last gasp of a cultural shift, around a cultural shift, and that we will, I think, as Americans have often done, we will find our way in this new reality. But I do think it's going to take, you know, the groups that have previously been in power, namely white Protestant Christians, you know, taking seriously that they don't own the table anymore, that they're basically going to be guests at a communally owned table, to kind of use, you know, a metaphor. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a real shift, and I think it's not going to come easily. So I think in the long run, I'm hopeful. In the short run, we may be in for a little, you know, one sort of final set of something that may be quite a bumpy ride.
There's more still to come on this State of Belief Book Club Best of Show. You'll hear Dr. Nora Rose Musnick discussing her book, Arab and Jewish Women in Kentucky, Stories of Audacity and Accommodation. But first, the father of framing on moral politics, how liberals and conservatives think. Now, if you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Dr. George Lakoff is an esteemed cognitive linguist and educator, scholar, and author who combines an understanding of archetypes with how language influences behavior, particularly political behavior. His invaluable book, Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, had just been published in an updated paperback edition late last year when we first brought you the following conversation. You make clear in your writing that there's no way to briefly summarize an analysis of Donald Trump and his supporters, so I won't ask you to do that. The bottom line is that what the media does in focusing on Trump's extreme statements actually enables people to like more what he says and strengthen support for him. Is that right?
Right. He keeps repeating.
Okay.
Crooked Hillary, win, et cetera.
How about Hillary Clinton? Looking at her campaign, what should she be talking about right now?
Well, two things have been very important about her campaign. At first, she followed advisors who said she had to show she's stronger than any man and knows more policy. And she came on as the woman of steel, you know, out there, you know, with a sort of helmet hairdo and so on, mm-hmm. et cetera. And that didn't play as well as they had hoped. And in fact, it isn't who she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not like that personally. I know her. She's actually a very nice, sweet person,
mm-hmm.
and very thoughtful, kind person. And finally, people like Joel Benenson, who's her pollster and a very smart guy, got the convention to let her be who she was, to talk about caring, about love in the election, and so on, and also to get her to come on as herself in the first debate. You know, and that has worked very well. Because, you know, she is like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what she does is communicate care. She communicates empathy. And she has care and empathy. But it's important to communicate that, which is a very important, a very major thing. And then she comes out and says, okay, because I care about the American people, here's what has to be done. And then she has actual policies and knows how to deal with it and so on, and she goes through that. And what has happened on the other side is for 25 years, people have said that you can't trust her. She's, you know, crooked. She's, does this, that, and the other thing that's illegal, blah, blah, blah. And you get lots of other things, none of which has shown out to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But there it is. You repeat it over and over again, and it gets in the brains of the people who hear it over and over again.
What is astonishing when I talk with you is I more and more understand what's happening right in front of us, though most of us don't explain why that's happening. Beyond even the eventual results of this election campaign, there is so much that has changed about what is seen as permissible, how much a candidate can get away with in public rhetoric. That genie is not going back in the bottle, I don't think. So what are the likely lasting effects of this new normal, do you think?
The lasting effects are these. First of all, there are probably 20 to 30% of the population who have strict father morality, and a number of them are women who agree that, you know, their husband's authority should be supported, period. So you have that as part of the way people understand the world. It's their worldview. It's built into their brains, you know, without having, an equally balanced part of their worldview saying, hey, we're progressive, we care about everybody, et cetera, on various kinds of issues but not other issues. And what's happened is the country has become more and more conservative because of the actual efforts of things like the Leadership Institute, which has trained 160,000 people over the last 20 years to go out and talk in their local communities and to be booked on radio and TV to think and talk conservative. You've heard it over and over, and then a lot of these things have been repeated over and over.
Wow.
That's not going away. Mm-hmm. And, so the question is, how do you deal with it? And the answer is by getting a citizens' communication network out there of citizens who have caring, nurturant, empathetic views, and who can actually articulate them. And that's a very, very important thing. A lot of the progressive views are never said. They're never articulated. And let me give you an example of that. It turns out that in progressive politics, the version of the nurturing parent family goes like this. It says, citizens care about other citizens. They work through their government to provide public resources for everybody, including business. And this happened from the beginning of our country. So from the beginning of a country, we had, the government providing roads and bridges, which were for businesses to get their goods there and for people to travel. It had public education, good for both individuals and for businesses to have educated workers. Then it had a national bank, great for business. It had a patent office, great for business. Interstate commerce, great for business. A judicial system, 90% for business law, great for business, and so on. In short, this country was set up so that those public resources were necessary for business. And now we've had much more. Where did computer science come from? The National Science Foundation supported it and allowed it to come into being. That was a government thing. Where did satellite communication come from? NASA and NOAA, government agencies that supported and allowed there to be satellite communication. What about GPS systems and cell phones? The Defense Department maintains a satellite system out there that is so detailed that it allows GPS and cell phones to operate, because when you send a message to another part of the country or the world, it has to go up to a satellite. There are 24 of them. You go satellite to satellite to satellite all the way around, like 12 of them, and then down to where you're going. And it has the timing must be in nanoseconds, billionths of a second, so that if they're a millionth of a second off, you're off by 1,000 miles or 400 miles or so on your message. You won't be able to use a cell phone or a GPS system. Mm. Well, the world economy depends on cell phones. Mm. Our government is supporting not only our economy and your use of cell phones and GPS systems, but everybody's. And this is something people don't know, that the private depends on public resources. Mm. And those public resources are what allow you to be free. If you don't have education, you're not free. If you don't have health care, you're not free. You know, if you have cancer and no health care, you're not free. You know, and similarly, if you have a business but you don't have any roads or or anything to get your ideas out there, to get your advertising out there, to get your goods out there, if you don't have airports supported by the federal government and state governments, if you don't have that, you can't run a business. In short, private enterprise and private life depends not just on private real enterprise, which it does, but it also depends on public resources. That message isn't out there. That's every true. Progressive knows this. If you go and talk to a liberal, they say, well, of course that's true. And if you ask them, have you ever said it out loud? The answer is no, they haven't.
George, do you have a strong feeling about how all of this is going to end?
I think, first of all, that Hillary will win the election. I think that the Trump supporters will be very angered. There may be violence, which would be pretty terrible. You know, we had the first firebombing this week, and there may very well be firing. There's a firebombing against the traditional Republican Party in a city where the Republicans and the Democrats were getting along. So the Republicans were not pro-Trump Republicans, refusing to talk to Democrats. And this is very important. Trump isn't going away. You know, he's got tens of millions of people out there, you know, who are real, and hundreds of thousands of people who have a really strong, strict father view that this is what's right and what is their identity. Now, the question is, will he be able to get them to form a militia, something violent, or some other means of communication to keep getting the messages out there? You can bet that they're going to be attacking Democrats and Hillary every day. Mm-hmm. So this isn't going away. This is now part of our politics, and we have to learn how to deal with it and how to talk about it and how to understand it.
As I said at the beginning, there is no way to truly summarize the important writing that George Lakoff has done around this year's election. And so let me urge every one of you listening to take the time to read George Lakoff's columns, Understanding Trump and Understanding Trump's Use of Language. We'll link to both of those on stateofbelief.com. George Lakoff is Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of a number of important books. There's an all-new, updated edition of George Lakoff's book, Don't Think of an Elephant. It is available now. George, thank you for doing...
Thank you, Wilton. By the way, there's a new third edition of Moral Politics about this election that has just come out this week.
Terrific book. Terrific book. And, George, thank you for giving us time and being on State of Belief again.
Always great to be here, Welton.
Take care.
I'm glad you're doing all that you're doing.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. It's not enough to identify sources and degrees of conflict and contention in our culture. We've got to look for models of agreement and accommodation if we're to have a future as a nation. And one such model appeared in the 2012 book titled Arab and Jewish Women in Kentucky, Stories of Audacity and Accommodation. Here's part of my conversation with author Nora Rose Musnick. start by talking a little bit about the communities that you write about in this book.
What you see in the book is the progression of families and their movement. So you have families who started out in eastern Kentucky in small town in the mountains in Appalachia, like Teresa Isaac, who was mayor of Lexington in 2006. But her family, her Lebanese family, started out in Appalachia and slowly moved their way to central Kentucky. Then I also talked with family members of Sarah and Frances Myers, who were Jewish sisters who had an elegant women's store in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. People may recognize Hopkinsville because it's home of Fort Campbell. Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a line very early in the book. It struck me and stayed with me. You were talking about the diversity of these people and the challenge of understanding and the way they've handled that. And you said something like, isn't it strange that you can see in Kentucky what you might not can see together in the Middle East?
And I would say not just the Middle East, but also urban areas in this country. We associate Jews with New York traditionally and Arabs with Michigan, and that we don't expect them to be in places like Kentucky and how we've come across each other and know each other here.
Yeah. I wonder if there's maybe a story from the book that you could summarize for our listeners just to give us a better sense of the world that you're writing about.
Well, one that I think is a funny story is about Sylvia Green and Mike Rawadi, who she's a Holocaust survivor, and he's of Lebanese descent, was born and raised in Winchester, Kentucky. And they're dear old friends, and she's in her 80s and he's in his 90s. And we were having lunch together one day in Winchester, and a woman came up, you know, a non-Arab or a non-Jew came up to us and said, "Mrs. Green, I'm so happy to see you. I was just in D.C. and went to the Holocaust Museum. Have you been there?" And she said, "No, honey, I lived it. I don't need to go to the museum." And then she turned to Mike Rawadi and said, "Mr. Rawadi, do you remember my dad?" And she named her dad. And he said, "Well, of course I remember your dad. My mother always recognized his shoes in the Ku Klux Klan parade."
Oh, my goodness.
So
that's great.
Isn't that a good lunchtime interaction?
I mean, that's exactly right. Well, what drew you to write this book?
It's my story. I'm a Jewish Kentuckian and was raised here in Kentucky. The other part of the story is that my father taught at a small school, a small college here in Lexington for nearly four decades called Transylvania. And he befriended numerous students. And some of the students he befriended just so happened to be Palestinian Christians. And they were from one family, the Ackles. And they would send family member after family member to Transy, and our families melded into this long-lasting friendship that continues today. Mm-hmm. And the eldest member of the family, Musa Ackle, or Sita, which is Arabic for grandfather, when I was in graduate school, I would go see him every Friday afternoon and have tea with him, and he would tell me stories about taking a boat from New York to Palestine and how he fell in love with a Jewish woman on one of those boat rides. And he would tell me how he peddled goods throughout the American South. And I realized that our families had very similar immigrant tales. Mm-hmm. And that's what spurred me to pursue this work.
Okay. I've got to ask, I mean, can you tell us another story?
Another story.
Another story.
I think the Meyer sisters were amazing women. I never met them. They died in the 1980s. Uh-huh. But the ones I spoke of who were from Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Uh-huh. and they had this fancy women's clothing store, and they dress military dignitaries' wives. So General Westmoreland's wife would come in there and shop when they were there, and they were sort of rebellious women in a church-going town. These Jewish women every Sunday would have cocktail parties by the pool and be smoking cigarettes and drinking while the rest of the community was at church. And what I love is that our Colonel Kritz, his daughter, would come in there to shop, and then they were sent overseas to Paris. They were stationed there. Mm-hmm. And then she was getting married, the daughter was getting married, and sent for Sarah to be her fashion aide. So I can read you a little bit from the Nashville Tennessean that talked about it.
Dude, that'd be great.
Since the Kritz family has been residing in Paris, the bride-elect has attended showings at the famous houses of Christian Dior, Chanel, and Balmain. She found their fashions extravagantly pretty, but Miss Kritz had always dreamed that when it came time for her wedding that Miss Myers would be her fashion aide, and so her dream will come true.
I think
is amazing that they're in Paris and they sent for fashion help from Kentucky.
Isn't that something? Well, I know that in addition to the delightful stories, there are lessons that communities can learn from the book. What are some of those lessons?
The stereotype that Kentucky is not a place where ethnic people live.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would hope that one lesson from the book is that we are here and we have unique stories to tell, and hopefully someone might listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
The other lesson that I would hope people would take away from it is that I think the inclination is to really separate Arabs and Jews and to think of us as enemies involved in global and biblical proportion conflict, and that actually our lives really overlap and we confuse ourselves and others confuse us to be one another, and the interactions we have are really complicated.
Dr. Muzdig, if you were telling a person why it is important for our listeners to know this book, what would you say?
Well, I think the reality is that Middle East tensions and conflict have a political life in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anyone who's paying attention knows that those tensions can be really high and the conversations can be difficult or not exist at all between Arabs and Jews. And I would hope that women's words in particular and women's stories and stories that I believe are coming from the heart can open up conversations and offer a possibility to have conversations that otherwise might not take place.
Mm-hmm. What surprised you in writing the book?
Well, I learned a lot more about the Muslim community in Kentucky. I guess what surprised me about it here is the extent to which it's very international. There are people who are from Iraq. There are people who are from Palestine and Pakistanis, mm-hmm. and Muslims from Africa. And from what I gather, what they tell me is that in urban areas in the U.S., these communities segregate, so you have the Pakistanis all together, you have the mm-hmm. Palestinians from Ramallah, and here in Kentucky, where there aren't as many people, that the community is much more international, so they come together as Muslims, irrespective of their nationality and their background.
Well, that's a great insight, too. What did writing this book do to you?
You know, it's funny because I think there are points in the book where I call the people in the book my interviewees.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a joke because the people in the book have become so much a part of my life that I don't know my life without them.
Hmm.
And I even forget that I got to know them through the book because it seems like we've always known each other.
The book is called Arab and Jewish Women in Kentucky, Stories of Audacity and Accommodation. and it's just out from the University Press of Kentucky. Dr. Musnick, I really thank you for being with us, and I thank you for listening to our show, and I thank you for giving the public this very fine book.
Well, thank you for having me and all the work that you do.
Now, before we go, the rather doom and gloom tone of my Independence Day commentary last week provoked a surprising number of responses. Listeners that I heard from may not have all shared my exact sentiments, but the level of fear and frustration, the sense that things have spiraled out of control in our culture and our politics, and there is little that any of us can do about it at this point, is certainly shared across political and ideological lines. In recent years, reputable research firms have revealed some deeply disturbing truths about the American electorate. Gallup finds remarkable and rising levels of admiration and support for Putin's Russia among Southern Republicans in this country, for example. Also, Pew is reporting that a shocking majority of conservatives consider our institutions of higher learning bad for America. And it goes on and on. Now, for many of us, it really does feel like Alice through the looking glass. We'll explore all of that in future shows. But right now, in a time such as this, all I can do is urge each of us to not get lost in the arguments and seemingly insurmountable divisions. Take time to be with those you treasure, disconnected from the endless anger and noise of the divisiveness machine. Nourish yourself spiritually in the ways that work best for you. Remind yourself of your priorities daily, hourly, if need be. From the moment in history that we are inhabiting, I don't think there is an easy nor a safe way forward. But friends, we do need to be ready to move forward. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, so much thanks goes out to you. We need your support. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or those persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound?